poverty juxtaposed with, you know, extreme natural beauty and ecological damage, I think the problems that those represent really directed my thinking and my learning.
Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. My name is Armand and I'm happy to be back with you all. Today's guest is Drew Jacobson. I met Drew a couple weeks ago and after I heard his story, I was very inspired and motivated to invite him to the SIM podcast so you all can also get inspired from his story. But how are you doing, Jacob?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks. Yeah.
Drew, like in all of our episodes, I made it a tradition that we start with a very simple question. This question is simple, it's very, I think, forward. But it leads us very interesting journeys and inspiring stories. And the question is, Drew Jacobson, what is your story?
Right. So I don't know. I feel like that is a simple question, but, you know, complicated answer. It can be taken so many different ways. I feel like, when I think about that question, I think, like, who am I? That's, like, a good place to start, you know? And generally, I'm a product of my experiences, right? So that's where I've lived, what I look like, what I've spent my time on, where I've worked, where I've gone to school, all those things. So I figure I'll kind of just start from the beginning and move to the present. Mm-hmm. So my story begins in Eugene, Oregon, where I was born and raised for most of my life. And Oregon, as you know, is a beautiful place full of nature and abundance and lots of space and not a lot of people too, compared to a lot of parts of the world. In terms of my upbringing, I was raised in a Christian home. I'm a white man in America. And so those things shape the way I see institutions and the way I see opportunity. And it's important to note too that those do limit my perspective in some ways. So my two younger brothers and I, were raised by our two parents who are both, public school teachers, and their parents were public servants before them. And so, you know, living in this environment, with this family really instilled values of public service, of environmentalism, love for God, love for my fellow person, things like that. So, fast forwarding a little bit to end of sixth grade, toward the end of sixth grade, my parents sat my two brothers and I down at the kitchen table and told us, boys, we are moving in a few months to Chile. And there will be my brothers and I, well, okay, a couple months later, we moved. And my brothers and I attended an international school where my parents both taught. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was a spectacular opportunity and, you know, invaluable experience of being removed from everything I knew, really anything I'd ever known, and being put in a very, very different place.
A culture shock, right?
Absolute culture shock. And you know, culture shock doesn't quite set in for the first couple months at first. It kind of still, you know, that honeymoon phase almost, like it feels like it could just be a vacation. But then it starts to sink in, like, oh my gosh, like, I haven't seen my friends in 3 months, and I don't speak the same language as these people, you know, like, all these things start to set in. But once I got past that, you know, I feel like I was really able to absorb the rich, rich cultures that exist in Latin America. I attended, like I said, an international school, so I was exposed to kids from all over the planet, and that was pretty special. Now, something I think worth noting about the city I was in, Santiago, you know, the city is set in the Andes Mountains. So it's in this beautiful setting with just big white capped mountain ranges all around it. But it also has really, some really bad poverty and really bad ecological damage. So I think One of the most shocking images that stuck with me from that experience was actually the first time driving to our place from the airport. I look out the window and we're driving on the freeway, and next to us is this, you know, 200 foot, 300 foot wide kind of cement canal. Yeah. That should have had a river in it, but instead it was this little trickle of brown water with trash all around it. Just past that, just miles or kilometers and kilometers of slums and shanties, of houses with tin roofs, and you know, just pretty desolate poverty. And behind that, the Andes Mountains, white-capped, beautiful nature with a layer of this dark brown haze that was the air pollution that's pretty endemic to the city. So I feel like that picture of the slums and the mountains, you know, that's something I really fixated on for years. And
what is the first thing that came to your mind, like when you see all of that?
You want to talk culture shock? I mean, that's just not something that I could have ever been exposed to living in the Willamette Valley. It's just the number of people and the number of people hurting was just immense and heavy and overwhelming. I mean, it was the same, like at my international school, it was like our school, which is this really nice campus, yada, yada, chain link fence all around it. And then more of just the slums and just poverty. And so, you know, those images of poverty juxtaposed with, you know, extreme natural beauty and ecological damage, I think the problems that those represent really directed my thinking and my learning for years to come, even after leaving, you know, especially after leaving Chile. So, you know, that experience of being abroad really set me up to think like a global citizen. It's still that value, talk values again, of you know, seeing issues through a global lens. It gave me a renewed appreciation for my country and my state and where I come from, while also being removed from it allows me to opportunities for critical reflection of my home country. And you know, that environmental damage and social issues that I witnessed, I guess you could say it bolstered my resolve to work in public service roles in the future.
So how old are you then?
So that was ages 12 to 14.
And you're thinking about all of this kind of stuff at 12.
You know, I would say those experiences more were like the shock of those experiences we'll say those planted seeds that...
Well, the spark, you know, like,
you know, whatever analogy you want, they sat there, and, you know, as I consumed more information and had more experiences, I watered them, or, you know, kindling spark, whatever your analogy, and, you know, it lit the fire, blossomed, what have you, into, you know, this drive that I think is what my main motivator is now, to do, you know, that public service. And so I came back to the U.S. and, you know, kind of having had those experiences and those images that just really stuck with me. And I guess I set out to explore my passions, to educate myself. So in high school, I attended an international baccalaureate program. So I got to continue that international learning, which is really great. And now here at OSU, I study environmental economics and policy, and then a double degree in sustainability. And those together, I think, have really allowed me to build off of those experiences I had overseas, and, you know, kind of learn how intersectional the issues facing our society really are. And, you know, I've had a number of opportunities since to explore and think about issues like wealth inequality, healthcare, climate change, as problems that are part of a larger system, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Drew, what is very interesting that, you know, the way you were thinking at a very young age. So I think the question is, what kind of made you to think like this? You know, was it the family that you were leaving, you know, was more of a, like a family that like always ask questions like, why is what is happening there? You know, like, you know, where does that critical thinking coming from? You know,
that's a great question. So my parents are both educators, like I said. So my brothers and I, learning was always the main focus. And it wasn't just academic learning that they were looking for. That's why they moved us to another country in the first place, is they wanted us to have that global perspective. They wanted that to shape how we viewed the world, which that's one of the greatest gifts they were able to give me growing up. And so, you know, I think that combined with where I came from, you know, Oregon, lush nature, my family, like we summer road trips where they happened every year to national parks and things like that. My family, you know, volunteers a lot. My grandmas especially volunteer a lot, soup kitchens, trash cleanups, you know, just community kind of oriented folk. And that's, I mean, that was just the environment I grew up in. And so it was almost like, almost that expectation, you know, that you're going to see a problem and want to be part of that solution. And so I guess it came easy. That was just, there was the expectation, but, you know, just the intrinsic, you know, internal motivation too, of seeing the problem and being willing to be part of that solution.
So Drew, you said you have a brother too that was traveling with you to Chile too.
Yeah, younger brothers.
Is it younger brother?
Both of them are younger. Yeah, two younger brothers.
What's the age difference?
So one of them, so there's me, and then there's an 18-year-old, and then a 15-year-old.
Did they see the world in the same lens, or they had a very different point of view?
I think especially the youngest was too young at that point.
Yeah, that one was kind of hard to expect to see that way. But how about the middle one?
You know, that's a great question. The middle one, the middle brother, he, you know, he's very athletic, very good at sports. And so that was kind of like his community, his identity, athlete. And then you go to Chile and football does not mean football like it does here. Right.
It's so soccer. Good at football and soccer.
Yeah, soccer. Exactly. So I remember I don't know if he wants me to share this, but whatever. I went to one of his basketball games, and he was the only kid on the court on his team who knew how to play basketball. And he was just so frustrated with his teammates and with the game that he was just crying because he was so mad. And, you know, he was like 11 at the time. So I think I can't really speak for how he perceived things, but I know that of the three of us, I had the best experience overseas. I think too, my brothers and I all attended Spanish immersion schools before we went to Chile. And so I obviously was there the longest and had the best, you know, was able to maneuver the language the best. Mm-hmm. Not that I was fluent, but, you know, so that probably helped my situation too. But I think just because of age alone, I came out with the best experience and the most, you know, perspective that stuck with me. I could be wrong, but that's the sense I get.
What are some questions you ask your parents when you are seeing what's happening in Chile and how different it is?
You know, I don't know if how many questions actually came up while we were there. I think questions started to come after, once I returned home and saw, you know, how things was reminded, I guess, of how things were here.
Yeah.
It wasn't really until then that I started to form those questions. Because I think in the moment, you know, when you're immersed in it, and as a 14-year-old, that, like, there's only so much that, you know, reflection that's going to happen there. But sure. I think that's how I can answer that, is once, it wasn't until I got older that I started, you know, asking my dad, why is the poverty so bad? Oh, and then he'll start to explain, oh, so history of colonialism, you know, the Chilean government was a dictatorship until pretty recently, very violent dictatorship, with Pinochet. So yeah, it wasn't until probably high school that I started to ask those questions, but those were the kind of the questions, just why is it like this? And he didn't have all the answers. So, and you know, I didn't get a lot of the answers until the last couple of years even of, you know, being in college and that kind of thing.
So you are more of a why person, that why that happens, why this going on. Is that something that even happened to you recently too, that you keep asking, why should I even do this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's easy to find the what, you know, as long you just have to look for it and it's there. The harder question is why. Why are things the way they are? Why do I do what I do? You know, all of these things are, there's a lot more nuance to them. There's a lot more of that intersectionality. So.
Because, you know, there are three questions: why, how, what, and how. What is what you do, and then how is the execution, and then why is the origin?
Mm-hmm.
No, and sounds like you tend to like more care about what is the origin, why this is happening, right?
Right. I mean, if you're gonna try to tackle any problem, you know, can do band-aid solutions all you want, but the problem is going to persist until you figure out why it's happening. Then you can go after why it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully bring a stop to it.
Let's move forward. So that's your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to college.
I come to college. And like I said, I guess I've reached this point now where I feel like I'm starting to be able to see that bigger picture. I've asked why enough times that I am seeing certain problems, you know, I'm asking why certain problems persist in our nation, you know, mm-hmm. racism, incoming inequality, poverty. Why do these still exist? If, you know, especially if, you know, we like to say we're the best country in the world, the US, most powerful country in the world, most, you know, economically powerful country in the world, then why are these things still happening? I had to know. So I've reached this point where I feel like I can't just focus on one issue, because now I'm starting to understand that bigger picture and how there a lot of these are really closely connected. And I guess that led me to government. So in 2019, I had recently taken a government class and, you know, it was, like I said, just starting to learn about how these issues connect to one another, and was interested in learning more about, you know, about our democracy, about how government can be an instrument for good in our society. And so this eventually led me to the state legislature. Like I said, 2019, I think it was, I reached out via email to the representative and the senator of my home district of Eugene. And Senator Manning emailed me right back and offered, asked if I'd like to meet him in person and we could talk about it. I said, sure. So, you know, I grabbed my suit from high school prom and
high school prom.
I haven't had a lot of reasons to be all formal until then, so there's that. And yeah, like I said, borrowed my girlfriend's car and drove up to Salem, wandered around the Capitol building till I found his office, and sat down and chatted with his chief of staff until he was done with his meeting, and then let me into his office and sat down with him. He just kind of wanted to know a little bit about me. I shared that I was interested in engaging more with the legislative process. Mm-hmm. And it also happened that in high school, the a cappella choir I was part of sang the national anthem at Senator Manning's swearing-in ceremony when he first became a senator. So I kind of had that connection. I shared that with him, and he offered me an internship just kind of on the spot. And I wasn't going to say no. So I said yes. And that was that. And so for the 2020 legislative session, I was his intern. And that was spectacular. And then, you know, at the end of that internship, I wanted more. It was like one of the most amazing job experiences I'd ever had. So I asked how I could further, you know, explore and engage with the legislative process, and I was offered a full-time position as his legislative aide, which is a role that I now play. It's been pretty great. I think you know that position and just working for the senator has allowed me opportunities to, you know, be exposed to issues that I'd never come in contact with, or ideas even that I'd never come in contact with before. One of my jobs as an intern and as a legislative aide is to answer the phone when it rings. And, you know, anyone will call a senator, from a constituent to a lobbyist to, and you know, all that. And so I'll answer the phone and I'll hear stories that are tragic. I'll hear stories that are wonderful. I've got people cussing me out over the phone. I've got people cussing the senator out over the phone, people who are really excited about something the senator's done, all this stuff. And that's, I think, I would say what's been one of the most rewarding parts of my job so far is, on one hand, I'm in the middle of the action. I am right there with one of the biggest change agents in the state. And I'm also getting exposed to all these stories and all these, you know, all these people's experiences that I wouldn't otherwise get to experience.
Let's take it. Let's look at this conversation in a different lens now. You said you're coming from a spiritual family, mm-hmm. and you're also a spiritual person. How does that spirituality affected your decision making for your journey?
That's a great question. You know, I think there's a few very clear messages in the Bible that, you know, you can't really get around. And the strongest one is love, right? Mm-hmm. You are to love your neighbor. You're to love your enemy. To love yourself. You're to love God. And so I think if you're going to take anything from the Bible, it is love. And so that's kind of what I've tried to lead my life with is, you know, love whenever I can, whenever possible. And I think that extends to public service. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't need to be something pretentious. I think it needs to be, it's something just as simple as, you know, I feel this drive to, make things better, you know? And I think my faith does play a role in that. And, you know, sometimes it's not easy to talk about because especially living in liberal Willamette Valley, there's a very strong, visceral reaction that a lot of people have to the Christian faith of seeing it as an institution of hatred, which is really unfortunate. And in some cases justified, you know, there are plenty of cases where people use the Christian faith as an instrument of hate, which is, it hurts so much to know that happens. And I understand why some people have that, that wariness about the Christian faith or about anybody, you know, who might be a Christian, but ultimately that's not what being a Christian is about, you know? And so I really tried hard to live my life along that value of love. And I think that's what's been a pretty strong guiding force to where I am today.
I want to ask, because you brought the concept of love, and I've been waiting in one of the podcasts to ask this question. And I think because now you talked about it, it's a good time to ask it. And I think it's hard to say, define love. It's just too hard, but it's hard. It's easy to say what is not love, I think. What do you think is not love?
Oh, yeah, I mean, That's an important question. So I suppose what is not love? I mean, my mind immediately goes to what is the opposite of love. The opposite of love is hate. The opposite of love is, you know, if love is to wish the best for someone, the opposite is to wish the worst for someone. So what is not love? Not love is to, you know, wish ill upon someone, is to try to make life harder for someone, mm-hmm. Which, you know, that's a pretty dark path to go down, I think. And that I don't think leads to much good.
Drew, it's, in my opinion, and I want to know yours. Love is a very, like, it's just four letters, but it has so much meaning. Yes, so much meaning. And I think love leads to optimism. Love leads to looking at life in a lens of, yes, it's hard, it's challenge, yes, but I'm gonna be fine. You know, that's something I see in love, you know, like, especially if you believe, you know, some people that are watching this may not be spiritual, but as a spiritual person, I always think, like, because I love God, and I'm pretty sure God loves me, so anything that happens to me is for a reason. You know, that's I think the foundation of that's the foundation that helps me to be optimistic. Sure. What are your thoughts about it? What do you think help leads to being an optimistic person?
You know, I want to acknowledge that it's easier for some people to be optimistic than others. Because a lot of, I think if your circumstances are better, you know, if you haven't experienced as much pain, if you can count on institutions to work for you, then I think it is easier to be optimistic. And then yet you have people who are in some of the most desolate situations who are still optimistic. So it's not, you know, it's not that clearly defined. But what makes someone optimistic? I'm not going to be able to give a great answer to that. But I can say what brings me optimism, is I think my faith does play a big role. I think there's a lot of promise in the Christian faith and in the Bible. And you know, I also think that I have so faith and hope are different, right? But I think hope is a very, very powerful force that comes from love, right? So if I'm loving and other people are loving, you know, that leads to hope. And if people can hope and people have hope, that I think is what leads, allows people to be optimistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can try to say that hope is flimsy and hope is, you know, whatever. But ultimately, hope, I think, is one of the most powerful forces that exists. It, you know, it's at the core of every revolution, every rebellion, everyone trying to make a change, everyone trying to bring about good. They are fueled with hope because, you know, they have to work against all odds to bring about something good. I think ultimately, I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of hope in people, because, you know, I've seen a lot of love in people. And so I think I just have a lot of faith, that things will turn out as long as people continue to love. And so I try my best to perpetuate that love.
That was a very actually amazing answer that you said, because hope is just, I remember my mom said, because I'm from Iran and things are not good back home. And she just told me, like, we are living because we have hope. We have hope. And I think this is something that a lot of people that are living in countries and or situations that are not good, they just have the hope for that one day, that things gonna get better. And you know, that hope keeps them alive, that keep them sane. And you know, it's just amazing. It's very powerful. It's very powerful. Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Jerry.
Of course.
So let's hear your dark moments or like failures or challenges? Those who, because we believe that those challenges are what we really make us who we are right now. You know, we learn a lot from the challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think so struggling with making mistakes is something, or, you know, not being able to forgive myself when I make mistakes is something that I've been working on really my whole life. And, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but I think I would even say that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life, is that if I'm able to forgive myself for mistakes I make, mm-hmm. things go better. Right. Mm-hmm. I think, I'll give you an example of a mistake I made recently. Luckily this wasn't a mistake that hurt anybody. But it's one that I'm still working on getting over. So last Thursday, I mentioned to you earlier that, you know, we had the legislative session, and senators were meeting and voting, and I was in our office and Senator Manning was down in, so I guess I was in Salem, I should start with that, in the Capitol building. I was in our office and Senator Manning was down on the Senate floor doing the votes and all that. And I needed to bring him a paper that he was going to read off of. And so I went down there and kind of, I came into the Senate chambers. It's this big grand building with, you know, lots of paint, or a room with lots of paintings and very formal. And I wait because somebody's speaking, and I wanted to be, you know, respectful. Once they finish speaking, I make my way out on the floor. And if you can imagine, if this is the Senate floor here, there's rows of chairs, like, of desks. And then there's like the main podium up here and a big walkway here and here. And Senator Manning's up here. So once the person's done talking, I walk through the middle of the aisle, hand him the paper, turn around and make my way out.
Yeah.
Thinking I did everything fine. Totally forgetting that one of the biggest rules in the Senate chamber is unless you are a legislator, you are not walking down that middle aisle.
Oh.
I just melted after I got off. I was like, as I'm walking off, everyone's looking at me. I'm seeing people shaking their heads and I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. And I get off and then, one of the Senate officials comes running up to me and is like, you can't do that. That is, you, unless you're a legislator, you can't walk there. Are you new here? You need to, here, come find me and I'll walk you through it, how to do it next time. And I was like, oh no. And you know, that is forever in the Senate archive. You can go online and go to the Oregon legislative website, click on the video of the last session and see me walking right there, hand the paper and walking back. And you know, that's not a very, like I said, it didn't hurt anybody. You know, it was just like a decorum thing. It's not easy for me to let those things go. And those are things that like, I'll be falling asleep at night, almost asleep. And then I remember them and I'm just like, oh, I'm awake again. And it's silly, I know, but like those kinds of things just sit with me. I think another recent example, this one where I did hurt somebody, was, you know, we've got a group of friends and it was one of their birthdays and they wanted to have a birthday party at another friend's house and they didn't want to invite a couple of our roommates who I'm, you know, close friends with, and I was invited, you know, and so I was put in that position of, do I go, knowing that me going is, you know, in their eyes complicit with that exclusion, or do I stay? I ended up going, and it really hurt one of my friends. And you know, I had a good time. It was fun. I got back, and then the next morning I wake up, and it's just like, oh, that was not the right thing to do. And you know, like at that point, the damage is done. There was some trust lost. And all I could do was ask for forgiveness, you know? Those are, I think those are two examples of mistakes that I've made. That you know, they're just things you have to be able to forgive yourself too. I don't know if that's quite what you were looking for with that question.
Well, I mean, the examples that you just shared, what you went through, was actually very, very interesting, you know, because especially the second one, when you said, I hurt somebody, and I was thinking, like, before you retell the story, it was like, what does he mean by that, you know? And then when you talked about it, I start thinking, I'm still thinking about it, and I'm not sure what my answer is. That is that selfish to make that move? Is that selfish to go to that party or whatever? Or is that just your choice and you can make any choice for yourself? So I don't know. I don't know if it's okay to be selfish in those moments or not. What do you think?
Sorry, it looks like I cut out there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. You asked about, is it selfish? And that's where I got cut off.
Yeah. Do you think, is it being selfish? Is it okay? Is it okay to be selfish even, you know, in those moments?
I mean, I sure convinced myself it was when I went. But you know what? I don't think, you know, I think there are very few cases where it's all right to hurt somebody, period, you know, especially when it's to hurt somebody to help yourself. I think in that moment, you know, it's been something, you know, feeling like I'm included is something that I've, or being excluded is something that I've struggled with a lot in my life. And so I think it was kind of that instinct that fueled my decision-making and allowed me to think, oh, it's fine, you know, if their feelings are hurt, because it means that I got to feel included and all that. But I think at the end of the day, and, you know, years down the line, would I have rather have been selfish and had that one night of experience, or would I have rather had not damaged a friendship? And I think the answer is pretty clear there.
I want to move on from this topic, but do you think if would have not go, would that been hurting the person that invited you there?
I don't think in this case it would have. I think in this particular circumstance, I can go into a lot of details, but it just, in this case, I don't think it would have hurt the person inviting me. When I initially found out that there were these plans, I tried to figure out some way that the other two could be included. So we eventually were able to have like a first party at my place. So that everyone could be included. But you know, it at the end of the day, like, yeah, no, I think it wasn't going to hurt the person who invited me if I didn't go. So in this case, it was really just, I was the one benefiting at the expense of someone else. And that, I mean, like I said, that's hard to admit. But that's, I think, the truth. And, at this point, what I can do is to work on repairing that relationship, and you know, it's been going well. So,
does admitting, and this is just in general, just admitting a failure and accepting it help you to feel better within yourself? You know, accepting it for real.
Yeah, I mean, like I've said a couple times now, I'm somebody that really struggles with letting go when I make a mistake, when I mess up. You know, not everybody would be so, I mean, I assume not everybody would be so shaken by the example I shared earlier with walking on the wrong part of the Senate floor, like,
yeah,
a deal in reality, but I'm just somebody who has a really hard time letting those things go. So when I'm able to reach that point of forgiving myself, absolutely, it makes things much better.
Gotcha. Drew Jacobson, are you relatable? If yes, how are you relatable?
I think absolutely I'm relatable. You know, we've talked a little bit about times I've messed up or slacked off. You know, those aren't usually the first things you share about yourself, because there's a lot of pressure to be perfect or to seem perfect. I am not perfect. You know, we want to talk relatable. I hate making phone calls. I am chronically unable to schedule appointments in a timely fashion. There are plenty of times where I should be doing homework or work and I'm below 2 hours on TikTok. You know, I'm not perfect. And so I am relatable. You know, I mess up at work too. I told you that story. Another time I was asked by Senator Manning to get a handful of other senators to sign on to one of his bills, one of his pieces of legislation. And I put it off and didn't know that there was a deadline on Tuesday. And it comes to like Monday morning and the senator wanted to take the bill up to Salem to turn it in. And we had no signatures because I didn't do my job. And you know, honestly, I think under this lens of relatability because I am not perfect, if somebody doesn't think they're relatable, I don't think they're being honest with themselves, because what I think binds us as members of the human race even, is our humanity, is our imperfection. And the other side of that is our ability to love and respect one another regardless of those imperfections. So when you ask if I'm relatable, absolutely, I think I am. If you are an imperfect human being who makes mistakes, I can relate to you.
Thank you. Yeah, that I mean, that's definitely true. And that's why I'm asking this question. I think you said it, the biggest lesson you ever learned, but if you want to just quickly tell us about what's the biggest lesson you ever learned.
Yeah. So, you know, sticking with this theme, the biggest lesson I think I can learn, or that I have learned, is not one that I've fully been able to implement in my life. You know, it's something I'll probably never fully implement, but I will always be working toward. And that is forgiving myself when I make mistakes. You know, like I've been saying, try as I might, there are silly mistakes that I've made, most of them harmless, but mistakes nonetheless that do haunt me and stick with me. And if we're ever to grow as individuals, you know, we have to accept that we're going to make mistakes. In some cases, I'd probably make the same mistake more than once, right? But I know if I dwell on every time I said something wrong or did something cringy or even, you know, hurt somebody, I wouldn't be allowing myself the space to do differently in the future. And I think there's lots of, you know, like I've been saying, lots of messages in society that tell us that mistakes equals future, equals failure, or mistakes equals something's wrong with you. I don't buy that. You know, every time you make a mistake, you've just created an opportunity to better yourself. Every time you fall, you just created an opportunity to pick yourself up stronger than you were before, right?
Yeah. And,
you know, there was a time when it was super difficult for me to even put myself in situations where I might make mistakes. But I guess I eventually realized that spending my life tied down by the mistakes of the past prevents me from experiencing the present and the present. And that just wasn't something I was willing to do.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jer, for sharing. I'm gonna ask you, tell you a couple of words and tell me how you feel about them. Very quick, one word, two word maximum. Okay. That's a hard part about it.
So I have to give you a one word or two word response?
Yeah. Like, how do you feel about these words? Ready? First one, family.
Safe.
Nature.
Peace.
Public service.
critical?
God.
The answer.
Poverty.
Fixable.
Beaver Nation.
Sco Beavs.
Drew Jacobson.
That's me.
This conversation.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Drew, for sharing your story, for being very authentic today. And it was amazing talking to you. And I'm pretty sure whoever's watching this episode right now is feeling very more inspired by your answers, by your story. We call ourselves Yes I Am because we believe we can put anything in front of the Yes I Am and be that person. What would Drew Jacobson put in front of Yes I Am? Yes, I am.
Human. Yes, I am.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Drew, for being our guest today. Thank you all for watching this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share this episode with your loved ones, your family, your friends. And make sure to follow us at @YA_YesIAM. And as always, yes, I am. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.